Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin with an update on modern-day piracy, where a U.S. warship is in a standoff with four pirates holding an American captain of a merchant ship aboard a lifeboat off the coast of Somalia. We'll speak with Dr. Syed Sheikh Samatar, who's a professor of African history at Rutgers University and the editor-in-chief of the independent journal Horn of Africa. He has published 40 articles and 6 books on Somalia, including the most recent, Somalia, a Nation in Turmoil. And then we'll look at the defense budget, which has escaped scrutiny because of the crisis on Wall Street. The defense budget has actually gone up by $21 billion, and we'll examine cuts in future programs and the reordering of priorities with Lawrence Korb, who is the Director of National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information. Lawrence Korb served as the Assistant Secretary of Defense from 1981 to 1985 in the Reagan administration. And in that position, he administered about 70% of the defense budget. And then we'll talk about a story that has yet to be picked up by the press in this country. And that is the story of Catherine Gunn, who is a former intelligence officer in Britain, who broke ranks from the ultra-secret GCHQ, which is Britain's equivalent of the NSA, where she leaked the existence of an NSA memo that was about how the National Security Agency here in the United States was spying on members of the United Nations Security Council at the beginning of the Iraq War, and she tried to stop the Iraq War from within British intelligence. She just testified to a British parliamentary inquiry on March the 19th, and we'll be talking to her in the last segment. Let's now begin with the subject of the piracy off the coast of Somalia. We're joined by Dr. Syed Sheikh Samatar, Professor of African History at Rutgers University and the Editor-in-Chief of the independent journal Horn of Africa. He's published 40 articles and 6 books on Somalia, including his most recent, Somalia, a Nation in Turmoil. And of course, Dr. Samatar, the Somalia is also an African nation that has the longest coastline of any African state, and it is, for all intents and purposes, a failed state. So who do you deal with in order to get your hostages back? We seem to have a peculiar revisiting the 18th century, where President Adams and Thomas Jefferson were negotiating with the Barbary pirates, but back then they seemed to have more of a state than we have in terms of Somalia.
You're absolutely right. This looks like something of a deja vu of the 18th century and the Barbary coast. It seems to me at this point there are two pressing issues. One is a long-term dimension, and that is to try to secure the release of the American captive. They have only two choices. One is a peaceful one, and that is they could use through the excellent intermediary of the clan elders to intermediate between the pirates and the Americans. And I think that would take the form of the elders insisting that the pirates be given a safe conduct in return for the release of the American. The second method, choice they have, is a violent one, and namely an assault on the lifeboat. And that, I think, could take... If they were to choose that, I think the commandos would use submergers and under the cover of the darkness of the night, creep on the lifeboat from the bottom, and then I think a deafening bang in order to stagger the pirates. And hopefully at that time, then the captain would be able to leap out to safety.
Well, we're not sure. I don't, Dr. Samatar, whether the USS Bainbridge, the destroyer that's right next to the lifeboat from the freighter that holds the captain and the four Somali pirates, we're not sure whether the Bainbridge has SEALs aboard, Navy SEALs. But they did have an opportunity earlier when the captain jumped overboard and tried to swim to the ship. And for reasons which have never been made clear, the Navy didn't fire on the pirates. The pirates, in fact, fired on the captain, fired warning shots and forced him to return to the ship. So I guess what I'm suggesting here is that so far any military force has not been particularly used, and it comes with enormous hazards. The French just rescued some French aboard a yacht. They managed to free most of them, but they did kill one, the captain of the boat. The French owner of the boat saved his family and killed two pirates. So, you know, the batting average is not particularly good here.
Well, a commando assault has always its risks. You resort to that kind of assault only as a last option. Here, perhaps, time is on the side of the Americans. If they can just hold off taking action and play for time, perhaps the pirates would eventually come to realize that there is simply no way out.
Well, already apparently there's been a compromise, because at this point apparently the FBI is negotiating with the clan elders ashore, and they're not even asking for money now. They're just asking for safe passage. And the United States is refusing to give the four pirates safe passage, insisting that they be arrested. Two of them apparently come from, is it Puntland? Is that the...
Yes, Puntland.
Puntland. And then the two from the south. So they come from different clans. So my question to you is, what's the difference between clan leaders and warlords? Is there any sense that the people that they're negotiating with are somehow independent authorities, or are they directly involved in criminal activity?
Well, we see that's the $64,000 question, and that is why I was calling in our earlier program for the Americans to develop an effective human asset intelligence on the ground to know exactly what is what. In general, in Somali culture, there is a drastic difference between the warlords and the elders. Warlords are people who live by the gun and by force. Elders are traditional elders that are respected by both the pirates and the society at large, and their role historically has been that of peacemaking and resolving problems peacefully.
Well, we do have about 250 people held by pirates in these little port towns. And I imagine that any military action against anything on shore would place the lives of these 250 foreign nationals in jeopardy, would they not?
Yes, absolutely. And if I may return to the subject of the long-term possibilities here, it seems to me that there is a resource in that area that the international community is not taking advantage of at this point. You understand that this Puntland region is a region with a government, a police system, security system, and a president and cabinet ministers. And I cannot believe that this government is unaware or unable to control the pirates. I believe that they are on the take, colluding, implicated. And if I may further elucidate on that, in the last two centuries, there arose in that region a powerful sultanate, a kingdom, And that kingdom largely prospered on plundering ships that got wrecked in that area. So that region comes from that tradition. In fact, they would take the loot in the 18th and 19th century. They would take the loot, and the loot would be brought to the king, and the king would redistribute so that money, revenues from the loot were an important part of the budget of the sultanate. And the Somali Puntland government, in my view, is doing exactly that now.
Well, there is nominally a central government, but it's for all intents and purposes irrelevant. How do you, in fact, restore any kind of government in Somalia? It's referred to as a failed state. The Bush administration didn't help matters. They essentially got the Ethiopians to invade to get rid of the Islamists. There's always been this, I think, exaggerated threat from Al-Qaeda that, you know, apparently there's only a handful of Islamists, but they nevertheless, as a pretext to get rid of Al-Qaeda, they used the Ethiopians to invade. That seems to have backfired and increased the chaos.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you are right that the Bush encouraged Ethiopian invasion was a major plunder. I have always advised that the Ethiopian invasion was a tragically premature move. They should have allowed the mullahs or the so-called Islamists to try to rule the society. And within less than a year, I could guarantee, they would have discredited themselves by their barbarous imposition of medieval-type Islam, where they ban soccer games, music, and so on. And the Somali public would have gotten sick of them.
Well, the pirates, though, I mean, since that country's been at war for so long, the young men that are holding the American captain on that ship, they're not particularly afraid of dying, are they? Nobody in that country expects to live very long, do they?
Well, yes. I think you have put your finger on the matter. One of the problems, and a terrifying problem, is that the Somalis in general, and the pirates in particular, are not afraid of getting killed. And a man who is not afraid of getting killed necessarily makes the most dangerous enemy. But still, it is possible. I mean, this is not to say these people do not want to live. They do want to live. And taking advantage of that chance that they want to live should be taken advantage of in terms of trying to release the American.
Well, you mentioned, Dr. Saheed Sheikh Samatar, you mentioned the idea that we should increase, we should have, in our last conversation several months ago, you suggested that the United States develop an intelligence capability ashore to find out who's behind these pirates, who they are, because it all leads, almost like the mafia, it eventually leads up to the Don. And you felt that we'd be able to, you know, go after the real problem, target the big guys instead of the small fry. We don't have that capability. So what do we do? I mean, is there what was your original suggestion, though? You find out who's behind it all, and what, you just quietly threaten them?
If I may, there are two types of pirates. One is a small-time gangster group, freelance looters, who are not really a serious threat. The other group is a highly organized a criminal gangster group who are being financed by financiers in London, in Italy, in Nairobi, and in the Arab world. These are the guys who have the sophisticated equipment, the bazookas, the RPGs, the two-way communication gears. And again, all depends on intelligence. The Americans should develop intelligence to figure out, to find out who these fine overseas financiers are and go after them.
Now, when you say the overseas financiers in London, Rome, and Nairobi, are these the people who end up collecting the ransoms from the shipping companies? The Saudis just paid $100 million to get one of their big super tankers out. So are these the guys that are getting that kind of money, or are they sending money in to their warlord connections?
Precisely. The money, the ransom money is collected and then secretly brought to these financiers overseas, who put it into a large pool and then redistribute it.
That's a very interesting point, that maybe at the end of the day, the people we need to arrest are in London and Rome.
Yes, exactly. But for the time being, the American authorities should really go after the government of Puntland and inform them, of course, based on hard intelligence, and that the Americans know what the Puntland government is doing, and then they should hold carrot and stick the approach to them. You cooperate with us in stopping this criminal gangster enterprise. We will aid you. We will facilitate all kinds of diplomatic and economic assistance to you. If you don't cooperate with us, then they stick. And what would be the most effective stick? It would be to, with President Abdullah Farole, their current president, to freeze his assets and prevent him from traveling. That would be effective, I think.
Well, this government you refer to, the Puntland government, obviously it's not the central government. How identifiable is the leadership? You say they provide some kind of social services. They act as a government. How do they operate? Are they, again, I'm getting, trying to differentiate between tribal elders and warlords. Where would they be in between those two?
In that region, what we are talking about is a regional government. And the three elements in there are A, the pirates, B, the elders, C, the warlords, and fourth, the government. The government is, in fact, administered like a modern government, with a president who is regularly elected every 4 years, a parliament, a military, a police. In other words, it is a modern government, regional government, though.
So that's the there's somebody to talk to. I mean, are these the people that FBI are talking to?
I believe they are talking to, and as I said earlier, it is absolutely impossible that the Puntland government is not implicated. This kind of wholesale piracy, seizing ships left and right, is impossible without the collusion and maybe encouragement of the Puntland government.
Well, I thank you so much for filling us in on this country, which you clearly are extremely expert in, Dr. Sihid Sheikh Samatar. And I thank you for joining us here in Los Angeles this morning.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking then with Dr. Sihid Sheikh Samatar. He is a professor of African history at Rutgers University and the editor-in-chief of the independent journal Horn of Africa. He has published 40 articles and 6 books on Somalia, including his most recent, Somalia, A Nation in Turmoil. Let's now turn to the subject of the new defense budget, which was somewhat overshadowed, one, by the crisis on Wall Street, and two, by it was released at the time of the G20 trip last week. I'm joined by Lawrence Korb, who's the Director of National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information. Lawrence Korb served as the Assistant Secretary of State from 1981 to 1985 in the Reagan administration. And in that position, he administered about 70% of the defense budget. And one of the things that I think has been lost here, Lawrence Korb, is that in spite of the press about Secretary of State Defense Gates' determination to cut the defense budget, I understand at the end of the day it was actually increased by $21 billion.
That's correct. And in fact, the number that the Obama administration gave Secretary Gates for fiscal year 10, which is coming up on the 1st of October, is actually $10 billion more than the Bush administration had projected would needed to be spent in fiscal year 2010.
So all of the publicity that we've read about cutting the F-22 Raptor program, the V-22 vertical lift aircraft, the C-17, the Trident missile, the Future Combat System, Virginia-class submarines, Joint Strike Fighter, the Super Hornet, etc. How much of that is in the future, and how much of it is in the present?
Well, what happened was they terminated the F-22 at the number. Actually, it was a little more. In 2005, the Air Force and then Secretary Rumsfeld and President Bush agreed we build 183 F-22s. We got to 183 in the 2009 budget. Secretary Gates is terminating it at 187. He's actually putting four more in the supplemental, which doesn't count in the base budget.
Right, they lost three though, haven't they?
Well, they're up four where they thought. Now, yeah. They obviously every program needs to come to an end. So what Secretary Gates is just, you know, did what he said he was going to do last year. You know, he said that would end. To compensate for that is doubling the buy on the Joint Strike Fighter or the F-35. So actually, you're going to have more people working in the aerospace industry than you would have a year or so ago, because the Joint Strike Fighter is actually a very troubled program. I'm surprised that he's pushing ahead. You know, with the production there, it has a lot of problems that needs to be worked out. But nonetheless, that's in there. For the Future Combat System, what he did was take out the vehicle portion of it. They were going to go with a new lighter weight vehicle to put all of this high technology equipment on. He said, well, no, let's go ahead and buy, you know, these mine resistant vehicles, which we're using in Iraq and Afghanistan, because they're much better against improvised explosive devices. So basically what happened is the budget went up and you changed, you know, you got rid of some program or you terminated them, but you're adding others.
Well, it's interesting, though, Lawrence Korb, that the F-22 Raptor program, and the main criticism for that is that it's sort of irrelevant. It's a Cold War weapon system. And in this era of subnational and transnational threats, it seems rather irrelevant. The original 648 buy had a $88 billion price tag. That's in 2009 dollars. And the 183 that we're going to end up with, we're actually going to end up with a few more, cost about $73 billion. So the amazing thing is we get so many fewer planes for almost the same amount of money.
Well, that's correct. I mean, it's taken forever to go from research and development into production. In fact, they started the program when I was there in the Reagan administration, research and development. They awarded a contract for it in early 1990s. And actually, interesting enough, in 1999, Congress tried to cancel it. And then President Clinton threatened to veto the bill if they did. So, you know, they've gone ahead with it, and you're ending up with 187 for over $70 billion. And if you do the math, you can see how expensive that is.
And the other one that you just mentioned, the Joint Strike Fighter, It may also be somewhat an anachronism in the current strategic threat landscape, if that's the right term.
No, I think this Joint Strike Fighter is a good program because it's going to be used by both the Army, Navy, and Marines, and a lot of our allies have put money into it. So if we can get it under control, theoretically, we'll get 75% of the capability of the F-22 for about half the price. That assumes that we get it under control. What I don't think is that he should be doubling the production now when it has so many problems that need to be worked out. And if we don't get those costs under control, we could end up, you know, with this thing costing more money than we had expected.
So the other one, the F-22 is stealth and expensive. This one would have more utility. But so what are the problems that they haven't ironed out?
Well, basically what's happened is the cost estimates they gave seem to be unrealistic. They're having technical problems actually in going through the manufacturing stage because I think they promised more than was technically feasible for the price they were talking about, which is a whole other problem. I mean, if you take a look at the weapon systems the Pentagon has been producing, and if the General Accountability Office took a look at the major weapon systems, they said over the last 8 years, these things have grown in cost by close to $300 billion. I mean, and so the costs are going up, and we're getting, and the programs have been delayed, and we're getting less and less for, you know, the dollar we spent. And that's primarily as a result of poor management.
So in an overall sense, though, I understand, and since you were in the Pentagon during the Reagan administration, I'm sure you were aware of, if not involved in, these turf wars between the services. We've already heard that Robert Gates, the holdover from the Bush administration, the current Secretary of Defense, has butted heads with the Air Force generals, and there's apparently a sort of fighter jock culture there that he's been up against. They hate the idea of these pilotless drones because obviously they're pilots, you know.
Right.
But I haven't heard of him butting heads with the Navy brass. And it's pretty clear, is it not, that over the last few decades, the Navy's been getting an awful lot, if not the lion's share. And what we've discovered in these wars, you know, whether or not clearly they've been problematic, if not disastrous, but nevertheless, they have required the Army and the Marines, not the Navy.
Well, that's right. The Navy actually, the Chief of Naval Operations a year ago himself, but this was not Secretary Gates, said this new destroyer they were building, it's the DDG-1000, it's a Zumwalt-class destroyer, was just too expensive, and he wanted to cancel it at 2. Well, they worked out a deal, they're going to cancel it at 3 and go back to what they should have been doing, building a previous generation, the DDG-51s, which are more than adequate to deal with, you know, whatever you're going to have to deal with in the world. And they're going to build, you're going to develop those, and they're also going to develop what they call a littoral combat ship, a ship that can operate close to shore, where it would be more relevant in dealing with the type of conflicts that we have to fight. And then the interesting, Gates said, well, we're going to cut down the number of aircraft carriers in the Navy from 11 to 10. And I asked him this the other day. I was invited to breakfast with him. By 2040, well, okay, nobody can argue what something's going to happen, 31 years from now.
So, in other words, these coastal ships, these littoral ships, they'd be useful in Somalia, for example. I mean,
oh, yeah.
There's nothing more symbolic, I think, of asymmetrical warfare than this current standoff between a United States destroyer and
right.
a tiny little boat and a bunch of skiffs.
That's correct. And, yeah, I mean, and, this ship is so big, you're going to have to worry about refueling it. And obviously, I mean, it's got overwhelming firepower, but, you know, you can't blow these pirates out of the water because you kill the captain. And so, yeah, I mean, a literal combat ship would be much more useful in this environment.
So what about the changing priorities, though? There's been reports in the press that Secretary of Defense Gates is more concerned about, and you were ahead of manpower issues as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration. Is he more manpower friendly? I mean, there's been this division here between the toys for the boys and the boys and girls themselves.
Yeah, well, what happened was that the Bush administration and Secretary Rumsfeld resisted adding people to the Army and the Marine Corps, despite the fact that we were involved in two wars. And then in late 2006, President Bush changed his mind and authorized an increase of 92,500 for the Army and the Marines. This is active duty people. And Secretary Gates has basically gone along with that. That's nothing new. I guess people thought, you know, maybe he would cut it or not go ahead with it. But no, he did, and I think he was quite correct to continue that. But that was a decision that was made in late 2006, right as he was coming into the Pentagon.
So the fact that they've let a lot of Category 4 people in to make up for the ranks in Iraq, it apparently lowered the bar. Is that going to be changed? I mean,
well, no, it isn't, and that of course is a whole other issue. I mean, the fact is that, you know, since we're fighting, particularly Iraq was a very unpopular war, mothers, fathers, priests, ministers, rabbis, coaches were discouraging youngsters who might have gone into the Army from doing so. So in order for the Army to meet its quotas, even before it expanded, it had to lower the bar by Category 4, the people who score well below average on the Armed Forces qualification test, people without high school degrees, and then they were giving over 10-11% of the new recruits were getting what the Army called moral waivers, and this included felony convictions. I mean, you had over 800 people came into the service last year with felony convictions. And yeah, in the long term, that's going to catch up with you because the statistics show the more people like that you take, the more trouble they're going to cause both for themselves and for the people around them.
But there's also, you have to add to that, don't you, Lawrence Korb, the green card soldiers. There's an awful lot of green card soldiers, many of whom are not that proficient in the English language.
Well, again, yeah, I mean, you take someone in who, you know, doesn't understand English that well, you're going to have to spend a lot more time, training them. Roughly in all of the armed services, we have about 30,000 of, you know, people who have green cards. And you know, I applaud them for, you know, volunteering, and I think we should expedite their citizenship. But you're right, if you have a language problem, then it becomes, you know, then you're going to have to spend much more money training the people.
So just pulling back a little bit here, Lawrence Korb, to get an overall sense of the latest defense budget, which is again somewhat paradoxical that it actually increases spending by 21 billion, even though it's being advertised as a defense cutting budget. When are we going to start seeing a reordering of priorities?
Well, I think you're beginning. Gates took a step in the right direction. I mean, increasing the size of the Army and the Marines, killing high-priced weapon systems like the F-22 and the DDG-1000. He also canceled two national missile defense programs, that the airborne laser that really wasn't working well. So I think you're moving in the right direction, but you've got to keep going. As I say, you got to take the future combat system. I think he was right to cancel the vehicles, but the other technologies have a lot of problems, and I would, you know, make sure that I had those under control before I went ahead with it. And the other thing that's going to happen is by law they're mandated to do what they call a quadrennial defense review. And this will be the Obama's administration kind of step back and say, okay, where do we want to go, and then what programs do we want to fund? And so Gates has, I think, put him in the right direction, but it's really up to the president now to decide on a national security strategy and, you know, who, you know, his administration sees as the threats and, you know, the most likely use of military forces.
So Just in conclusion, then, Lawrence Korb, in terms of the financial disaster that the country faces, the fact that Wall Street still, to some extent, is in a free fall, and Main Street has not been stimulated, and there's talk of even a depression. How much is that impacting the defense budget? It doesn't appear to be.
No, it does not. In fact, aerospace stocks went up after
right.
Gates made his announcement. So the defense industry is doing well. And I think what we've seen from President Obama looking long term, he's going to keep the defense budget level just give it enough money to keep pace with inflation. So its real buying power will not decline over, you know, his administration.
And in terms of guns and butter argument, it's not going to fly, right? Because everybody's saying, well, we got to stimulate the economy with jobs. And one of the rationales for defense spending is that it doesn't matter what the product is, which is pretty extraordinary, but there's been less concern about what you buy than the fact that you employ people.
Well, yeah, but fortunately, when we get out of this, economic situation we're in, and you're going to try and get the budget balance, then you're going to have to make some hard choices between guns and butter. I mean, right now, if you look at what we're spending on defense, and even if you control for inflation, it's higher than what we spent at the height of Korea and Vietnam. It's the most we've spent since, you know, the end of World War II, and that's in, you know, putting it in a constant dollar. So you're going to have to stand back and say, okay, if I want to get this, you know, deficit under control, you know, let's take a hard look at defense and see if we can, you know, get some savings eventually. But right now, nobody wants to do that because, as you said, they're just trying to pump money into the economy. And even though defense is probably the least efficient way to put it in, it is one way to put it into the economy.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here this morning in Los Angeles, Lawrence Korb.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Master. Just speaking then with Lawrence Korb, who's the Director of National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's a Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress and a Senior Advisor to the Center for Defense Information. He served as the Assistant Secretary of Defense from 1981 to 1985 in the Reagan administration, and in that position he administered about 70% of the defense budget. He was awarded the Department of Defense Medal for Distinguished Public Service and served on active duty as a naval flight officer and retired from the Naval Reserve with the rank of captain. I'm now speaking with Catherine Gunn, who's a former British Secret Intelligence Officer with the ultra-secret GCHQ, Government Communications Headquarters in Cheltenham, England, and Marcia Mitchell, who is the co-author with her husband Tom of The Spy Who Tried to Stop a War, Catherine Gunn and the plot to sanction the Iraq invasion. Marcia Mitchell is a former associate director of the American Film Institute here in Hollywood and a former senior executive for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. She began her career as a journalist and has received national press awards for writing, editing, and photography. She's testified on the Catherine Gunn case before the prestigious Capitol Hill panel and was awarded numerous articles about the case and its place in the run-up to the Iraq War. With her husband, Tom, who's a former FBI counterintelligence agent, she wrote The Spy Who Seduced America, Lies and Betrayal in the Heart of the Cold War. And both Marcia Mitchell and her husband are the co-authors again of this new book, The Spy Who Tried to Stop the War. Marcia, are you with Catherine Gunn at the moment?
No, we are on the island of Montserrat in the British West Indies, and Catherine is in Cheltenham, England.
Oh, I see. I guess we're trying to get in touch with her. Until we do, tell us about how you came. Your husband is a former counterintelligence officer with the FBI. How did you come, you and Catherine, how did your paths meet and cross?
Our paths crossed in when we became very interested in her case, in what was happening in England. And because of Tom's connection, we get an intelligence report from London most mornings. And in London, this was a big story. And the interest, you know, was interesting to us because it was not being carried at all in the U.S. And the story, of course, was Catherine's leak of an illegal American spy operation against members of the UN Security Council. The U.S. press kept it very quiet, but we were getting information from England, and I was so fascinated with the story and eventually went through Norman Solomon to get in contact with Catherine, and a lot of people were trying to reach her, but she was being very cautious. And eventually I did get an email to her, and she responded with one line that said, "What do you want of me?" which was so interesting. And we became friends over email. Tom and I went to London and met her. And I found her one of the most interesting people in the world. And she agreed to let us do her story.
So just briefly before Catherine comes on, apparently she's putting her daughter to sleep and has to speak softly here. But let's just in broad strokes here. She was working for GCHQ, which is the equivalent of our National Security Agency.
Right.
And she discovered an NSA, that's our National Security Agency, memo. And she tried to use this memo within the intelligence community to stop the war. And I understand what the memo said was something to the effect, or what it revealed was, that the National Security Agency was spying on members of the United Nations Security Council at the time of the United Nations vote on to authorize the Iraq War, the famous testimony of Secretary of State Colin Powell before them, as you recall. Now, is that perhaps why this story is not breaking over here in the United States, is that nobody really wants to talk about the extent to which the NSA spies on...
Absolutely. And, you know, Michael Hayden, who was at the time head of NSA...
And who subsequently became the Director of Central Intelligence.
Right.
Right.
And he has said on several occasions, the NSA does nothing unlawful. And the NSA adheres to the bedrock of the international law. A number of comments like that. And, of course, this proves that what he's saying is not true. The National Security Council broke international law in what it did. And to keep putting forth to the American public this story that our intelligence community does nothing illegal is not something that the American press wants to cover. It's just not a topic for them.
I see. And Catherine Gunn, on March the 19th, you testified before British lawmakers asking them to commit a full public inquiry into the decision to invade Iraq. Where does that stand? Because clearly here in the United States, Catherine, we've had no such inquiry.
We haven't had a public inquiry here in the UK yet either, but Gordon Brown has promised that during his tenure of prime ministership, we will.
Because to some extent, England's been ahead of us, at least in terms of providing information. There was the famous Downing Street memo. It seems to be that where, you know, we've been getting most of our information, which subsequently we get sort of an echo of it over here. I mean, one of the great paradoxes, of course, is that here you are, somebody within the Secret Intelligence Services of the United Kingdom, trying to get your colleagues within the community, many of whom shares your beliefs, to force the government not to do something that subsequently proved to be disastrous. Ironically, over here, our government outed a sitting CIA officer. I'm sure you're aware of what happened with Valerie Plame.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that in itself got most of our attention, but. But what you are doing is so much more important, in the sense that you're trying to give us a flavor of what kind of sympathy you had within the community. I mean, all we recall at the time was the suicide of a Dr. Kelly, but there was no sense that there was a lot of angst within the community.
It's interesting because a couple of weeks ago I participated in Parliamentary Select Committee inquiry into the number of leaks and whistleblowing that have taken place since 2001. And the Parliamentary Select Committee is interested in why people have, within, you know, civil service, have been breaking secrecy laws and leaking information to the press and opposition parties in order to get the public to know what's going on. Like you said, the Downing Street memos, was a very important document that has basically confirmed that a regime change was what was going on all along about Iraq, and it had absolutely nothing to do with weapons of mass destruction, and also that they were going to fix the policy, fix the intelligence around policy, which I think is the wrong way around things should be. It should be fix in policy around what the intelligence is rather than what they were doing. So
there was another meeting recorded, if you recall, on January 31st, which is right after this experience of Catherine's, and it was a meeting in the Oval Office with George Bush, Tony Blair, and Condoleezza Rice. And at that meeting, they discussed both legal and illegal means of going to war against Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
The situation at the time was so volatile, and what Catherine did was so very important and so courageous. And you know, Daniel Ellsberg has said that her leak was the most important ever, and far more important than the Pentagon Papers.
Well, I understand at that time they were concocting all kinds of crazy ideas. First of all, they were using the overflights to make them as provocative as possible in the hope that Saddam would shoot down a coalition plane. And apparently there was even a discussion of sinking a passenger ferry and blaming it on Saddam.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't put anything past them at the time.
Uh-huh.
They were so eager to get their resolution for war.
But Catherine, you're and your colleagues are restrained, I think, by pretty onerous rules, and even the press in the United Kingdom is much more restrained. We have a First Amendment over here, even though we just mentioned earlier that nobody over here in the press seems to want to touch this story, which maybe suggests that we have some kind of informal form of censorship. But
right.
The long and the short of it is, they've always had these D notices, haven't they?
Yeah, well, it's something that doesn't really get talked about much in the UK press, but things often, when they come out in public, I mean, when my leak broke, and it was before my name became public, the story, it was splashed across headlines across the world, but in actual fact, it didn't stay in the UK press for very long either. It wasn't until my name came out that, you know, the fact that there was sort of human interest that they actually took more notice of it. But what to me seemed like the biggest issue, that the actual fact that the UK and US were attempting to subvert the workings of the UN, that story didn't actually generate as much interest as it did when my name came out.
And what specifically did happen to you in terms of punishment?
I lost my job, and I faced I faced prosecution. They charged me in November 2003 for breaking Britain's Official Secrecy Act. But then in February 2004, there was about turn, and out of the blue, they dropped all the charges against me. So my name is completely clear.
What have you figured out happened there?
Well, it's still debatable. There are a couple of things that I think were maybe a cause for the prosecution dropping the charges, one of which was that at the time, the Attorney General's advice was still under wraps, although there was mounting pressure for him to reveal his advice. And as it happens, that was leaked as well. So the government didn't openly disclose it. That came from somewhere inside as well. And that's told us that, in fact, the Attorney General did change his legal opinion within days of the run-up to the war. So we think, because my defense team wanted the Attorney General's full advice, that was possibly one of the reasons why they dropped the case. But of course, they deny this. And the other reason I suspect they dropped it is possibly because they were fearful that a jury might acquit me, and then that would set a legal precedent of the defense that my defense team was going to mount, which was defense of necessity, which is one of the potential clauses that they could introduce into the Official Secrecy Act, which would make it a little bit more protective of whistleblowers, because at the moment there's no protection for anybody who has signed the OSA if they do disclose information that pertains to the public interest.
So when you spoke before the Parliamentary Committee, there've already been an investigation by Lord Butler and Lord Hutton, right? And neither of which really got into the main questions about why did the US and the UK go to war.
That's right.
And we had a similar situation here where the Senate Select Intelligence Committee were mandated to do an investigation, and the chair of the committee at the time, Senator Jay Rockefeller, now chaired by Senator Feinstein, but the long and short of it is he was a piker. He failed us. So we've yet to be, just as the Downing Street memo and other leaks in England were the precursor for questions that were asked over here. Do you think that you and your colleagues in the United Kingdom can actually help us out over here by getting something rolling?
Well, yeah, it's interesting you should say that, because one of the questions that was put to me and two other members of the inquiry at the Parliamentary Select Committee was whether or not it would be worthy and advisable to have members of the intelligence community and maybe the Foreign Office and so forth to actually participate in a public inquiry into this invasion. And we said, all of us, I think, said yes, if there were, you know, caveats to protecting their involvement.
So this all began with a memo that you got from the NSA. I take it that I remember some time back reading a book by Desmond Ball called The Ties That Bind, that suggested that GCHQ and Cheltenham and NSA and the Australians and the Canadians and other of these secret intelligence eavesdropping operations do swap information. And there was even a suggestion that maybe they helped each other out by spying on to avoid the because we've had tremendous scandals over here about the extent to which the Bush administration authorized the NSA to spy on American citizens. So some of the stuff that Des Ball had written about years ago suggested that maybe there was a trade-off.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of the how it works, how did you, you know, can you tell us how you came across this memo? And because clearly the NSA are pretty, they're pretty, they used to be called no such agency. That's how tight-lipped they are.
Right. Well, I can't go into too much detail, but let's just say it was, I mean, like you say, there is a great deal of cooperation between NSA and GCHQ in particular, as Marsha and Tom Mitchell have gone into in their book. This dates back, till the beginning of each of the agencies, I suspect. But it was down to really the way the internal structure of GCHQ is organized, and it just so happened that I was on a team that also fell into other countries' categories, and therefore we were the recipients of the same email. In fact, it went not only to myself, but to over, I would say, 100 people in the agency.
And I believe that a lot of people inside the community were sympathetic with you, were they not?
I suspect they are, but of course, like you say, it's a very tight-lipped organization, and I've used this term before. I think in agencies such as ours, people tend to fall into groupthink by default, and it's easy to kind of be swallowed up in the whole system. But yes, there were people who subsequently have actually come to me and said, you know, good for you, girl, well done.
Well, let me just go back to Marcia and your Tom, your husband Tom, former FBI counterintelligence agents. In doing this book, and I believe that there's also a movie in the pipeline as well. Just to answer the question of how come the press hasn't seized on this more in this country? Have you had any problems or anybody leaned on you?
No, but we really expect that sort of thing to happen. I think that one of the interesting things that happened when I raised that question with a friend who happens to be to own a number of network affiliates in this country, and I raised the question with him. I said, why didn't you people cover this? Why wasn't this story covered? And his only answer to me was, I didn't think they had that kind of power anymore. And I said, who are they? And he just shrugged. And he said, during World War II, the broadcasters were asked not to cover certain things, and they didn't. And he referred to that. But he was very obtuse about it, and that was as much as he would say. The New York Times was questioned, and they said, well, we like to do our own research, and we're going to do our own story, but of course they never did. It was only right before Catherine was to appear at the Old Bailey, and Sean Penn and a group of American celebrities wrote a petition to the British government asking for leniency for Catherine and supporting her. And because film stars' names, and Gloria Steinem and others, Jesse Jackson, those people had signed a petition, a letter for Catherine and supporting her, then suddenly the press took note. I mean, it was not a matter of principle that brought them to that point. It was a matter of, oh, some celebrities are saying something.
Well, thank God for celebrities, I say. Here I am in Hollywood. I thank both of you for joining us here. I'm afraid we've run out of time. I thank you so much for joining us, Catherine Gunn.
Thank you for having me.
And also, I thank you, Marcia Mitchell.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Catherine Gunn, a former British Secret Intelligence Officer with the ultra-secret GCHQ. She leaked an NSA memo trying to stop the Iraq war from within the British intelligence community, and she was threatened with jail. And now, along with Marcia Mitchell and her co-author, husband Tom, they've written a book, The Spy Who Tried to Stop a War. I'd like to thank the producer, Louis Vandenberg, the associate producer, Elliot Fong, Jazz Shepherd, the engineer,